Hello, you're listening to Sarah Archer in episode 286 of the Speaking Club podcast. I want to start this show with a quote from Herman Melville. He's the guy that wrote the classic book, Moby Dick. We cannot live only for ourselves. 1,000 fibres connect us with our fellow men. And women, Herman. And women. I started this podcast for two reasons. Because I want to help people recognise the power of stories and humour in speaking, and because I believe it's your message that counts, not the number of ums and ahs you use. There are some organisations that want to create robot speakers. They want you to sacrifice your personality in order to speak perfectly. But I want to let you know that you can be yourself and a sensational speaker. So, if you want to be a speaker that connects and engages authentically through stories, a speaker that gives value as well as a great performance, then welcome home. Hey, how are you? I am very well. My ankle is healing up. If you didn't hear, I fell off a wall climbing onto a mat, but badly sprained it. But anyway, it's healing nicely and I'm feeling fantastic. And on top of that, I am super excited because over the past few months, which is why the podcast has been a bit sporadic, I've been working on a new program designed for non-fiction authors who want to get paid to speak and make change happen. And this program is ready to go. Well, we've actually got our first members in and it hasn't even been launched yet. And it's called The Green Room. And if you haven't heard that term before, you'd normally come across it in any performance venue, whether that's for music or comedy or theatre, TV. And the green room is the room that the artists use to get ready to go on stage. And with my background, as you know, in comedy and theatre, I'm so thrilled to be able to bring that sort of vibe and reflect that in some way in this new speaking programme. And we will be launching it officially very soon, and I will share more details about it then. But if you're curious about it, then get in touch and I will share the details with you. But enough of the green room. We are here to talk to my guest, David Van Bennekom. When I met Dave on LinkedIn, he told me he'd written a self-help book on national security. And I'm not going to lie, I thought, that's a bit unusual, followed by, blimey, he's got some guts. That is a challenging topic. But my curiosity was well and truly piqued. And so I had a look at his profile and I saw that he was a former United States Marine Corps infantry and logistics officer. He was a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan and he'd retired from active service as a lieutenant colonel. And then I saw that besides that, he had a law degree and also a master's in national security law from Georgetown University. And so I thought, obviously, he's got the knowledge. But as I messaged him back to find out more, as I say, I'm contending the truth here. Based on previous conversations with some experts, I was fully expecting him to bore the pants off me. But do you know what? The opposite happened. When he started sharing about it, he didn't waffle on about facts and stats. No, he made me laugh. And even better, he gave me a light bulb moment or two about something truly important. And that's when I knew I had to get him on the show. Because being able to make something complex, technical and difficult, engaging and relatable to an audience is a key skill for writers and speakers. So if you want to get a different perspective on how to make your subject more entertaining, then sit back and listen to this conversation that I had with David Van Bennekom. Okay, let's start the interview. Welcome to the Speaking Club, David Van Bennekom.
Hi, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. I am very curious about this. We met on LinkedIn and we had a chat on the messaging part of LinkedIn. And I just found what you talk about and the way that you talk about it fascinating. So I wanted to dig deeper. So here we are. Now, you wrote a book. Can you give me the title of the book again for the audience?
Sure, it's Searching for True Community, a self-help book on national security.
Which is, I think people will immediately see why I was curious about it.
It's an odd one. Yeah, by all means.
So, first question I've got is, why did you write the book?
That's a great question. I think there's a little bit there about, at least what I saw as a need out there to just have better conversations about what really is a tough subject. And it's really hard for us to talk about it. We tend to get lectured, I think, a little bit about national security. I think there's a little bit of a wall between the people that really have a genuine interest in learning more and maybe those national security professionals that maybe don't feel like they necessarily have an incentive to bridge the gap there. And I thought we needed, especially today, wars around the world. I'm here in the States, we're questioning, what our role is here, is, whether we continue to be as engaged in the world as we've been in over the last 50, 60, 80 years, or we kind of retreat back a little bit. And I think these are kind of fundamental questions that we're all asking ourselves. We see it on the news, but we really just don't know how to talk about it. And I was hoping that through this kind of self-help idea, give us all kind of an opportunity to learn a little more and maybe engage in the discussion.
Can you remember the point, the trigger at which you thought, oh, I really need to write a book on this for people? Can you remember what happened? Was there something specific that triggered it?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't fall on this idea right away. It was really kind of more of a journey. But I just left the Marines. I was in the Marines for 20 years, the US Marines, and I had to take my first job at up in Connecticut at a financial services company. During my time in the Marine Corps, I'd put myself through law school at nights and weekends. And when in my last job, and I was working in the Pentagon, I had gone and taken this degree, an advanced legal degree in national security law from Georgetown University, which is here in the States, one of those premier kind of legal institutions we have. And I kind of sat there up in Connecticut and I kind of thought, it'd be a real shame if I didn't do something with it. I started kind of thinking, if I went to a culinary school and I never became a chef or, kind of opened a restaurant or wrote a cookbook or did something with it, it would just be a real waste. And so I kind of went through this process of, what can I do with it? I'm not in that national security world. I'm not in a think tank. I'm not working for the government. My military days are behind me. I'm not somebody you would necessarily recognize as an authoritative source. No one is coming to me to say, hey, Dave, tell me about national security, right? So I knew I had to do something really creative. But I think the real moment came where I knew the challenge that I was up against. And I share this in the book. I turn to my wife and I say, I don't really want to write a book about national security. She said, here's one word, boring. She's like, can't you find something more interesting to write about? It's kind of one of those responses maybe only your spouse can give you, right? So I was expecting her to say, hey, that's great, dear. Go for it. You're the best. But she didn't say that. And I think that was for the better because she really let me know what I was up against. And it was that most of us really do find it boring. It's a topic that's hard to get our hands around. We kind of identify it with maybe boring people wearing boring gray suits and on those kind of Sunday morning talk shows. And I think it's hard for us to connect to. And so I kind of sat down this journey and I thought, well, if I could write something that she would be interested in, that she wouldn't find boring, that maybe I can be successful. But I didn't really land on the self-help idea until I realized something about myself. I kind of had to do a little self-reflection, look myself in the mirror a little bit and realize something that I think we all know, but maybe we don't like to admit. And that is, just because we're smart on a topic doesn't mean people want to listen to us. And I realized that my wife wasn't really interested in talking to me about national security. I had this fancy degree and I had all this experience and I've been to, Iraq and Afghanistan and all these things in my Marine Corps days. But I was really the last person she wanted to talk to. And she really wanted to talk to her sister or her friends, people she trusts, and she can kind of feel like she's an equal member of the conversation. And so I realized that the book couldn't be about me. You won't find any of my thoughts in there about any of the national security events going on around the world. It really had to be about the reader's personal journey. And it had to be the reader wanting to take the conversation to the place they wanted to take it to, and with the person that they want to have it with. So I would be thrilled if no one ever asked me a question about national security, but they were having all these conversations around me. And I think that's really ultimately why I landed on this self-help book idea, getting really energized about it and, you know, kind of going forward.
Interesting. So what I was going to ask the next question, who is the book written for? But essentially it's your wife. And she was your target audience for the book and people like her, I'm guessing.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of my peers will write in the foreign policy magazines and they'll write for their law reviews in their schools and those kind of things. But, you know, there's not a lot of incentive to reach out to new markets, to people who maybe don't have that background and don't have an understanding. But you know, they're watching the news and they have a real desire to learn more. So it was my wife that kind of really sparked the idea that if I was going to be successful, I wasn't going to write in those law journals or in those kind of foreign policy magazines. I was going to write for people who want to feel empowered themselves to find their voice so they can participate in discussion. And for those 3.5 years, I strained over it to kind of get there. But again, you know, the idea is that if I can make it fun and entertaining and I can make it relatable to my next door neighbor, to my wife, to, you know, the person down the street, then I could be successful.
Oh, I like that. So my next question is kind of like, what is the big idea that you want to get across to people? And I feel from what you've said so far, and I guess this is test it out with you, is that a lot of people want to have an opinion. It's one of those sort of big things that people find it difficult to get a handle around. And it feels to me like you're aiming for them to have an informed opinion so that they feel like I can have I don't feel at the moment I can have an opinion because I don't know enough about it, you know, and I'll probably say the wrong thing. But as a result of reading your book, they can have an informed opinion. Would that be right? Or is it something different?
Well, one is that I don't think you can say the wrong thing. So it's, you know, I think your opinion matters. And I guess that's the one message I want to get across is that we have all the tool sets that you need in order to participate in this because you just don't really know it yet. And I want to connect the reader to really to their everyday lives. So, you know, basically the approach I take in the book and the theme that kind of goes all the way, you know, through it. And the reason I call it Searching for True Community is that really the community of nations isn't unlike, you know, your own communities in your own local neighborhoods, right? There's, you know, if you kind of think about it this way, you know, every house has a, you know, a different family that likely looks different, practices a different religion, has a different culture than all the other families around them. But as different as they are, right, we agree that there are at least some common rules that help us work together as neighbors. The problem is, and again, we all have this experience, is that, you know, it's hard to keep communities together because sooner or later, those communities are going to put a little too much on us or are going to stress our values and kind of challenge our individuality to the point where we start to question whether it's a good idea to be part of that community or part of that group. And so, you know, we always have that challenge that diversity can lead to divisiveness and divisiveness can certainly lead to conflict. But it's something that we all know because we live and work in our own communities every day. And once we make that connection, you realize that I live in this kind of little, you know, neighborhood. I have a homeowners association that I deal with. I go to my PTA meetings, those kind of things. You know, some of the real fundamental, I think, similarities to international law and these kind of big, you know, kind of agencies that kind of help oil the gears within the, you know, community nation. So, you know, if I can get that across, if I can get that, hey, you've already have just through your experiences and daily interaction with your own neighbors that you already have a head start on being a national security expert. And, you know, maybe in your own way you are, then you can really engage into the subject and hopefully spark an interest. And I guess that's the end. That's really what I'm trying to do. You know, I'm not really trying to get the reader to the mountaintop, but what I can do is get you to the base camp and give you kind of maybe the base, you know, equipment that you need to wear and kind of give you a little tent that you can stay in and then kind of let you kind of look up the slope yourself and decide if it's a climb you want to take. Who should be your Sherpa that's going to kind of take you on that next step and what path that you think you want to take in order to get to the top. And then challenge those national security experts on what they're telling you. And if we can challenge them, we can change conversations. You know, one of the things I really want to highlight in this kind of self-help genre is our relationship today with our physician is much different than when I was a kid or when my parents were a kid. Because at some point, someone decided somewhere that it was a good idea for us to take more ownership in our own health, right? You know, when I was kind of graduating college, I used to frequent this site called Motley Fool, right, to get a little better, knowledge on my own financial kind of well-being. E-Trade pops up, WebMD, all these tools have popped up in order to, really empower us in order to be, have more ownership in our own future. And that doesn't mean that the doctors go away. It doesn't mean there are still plenty of financial planners out there to kind of guide us in towards retirement or whatever our financial goals are. It just means the conversation changed. We don't have to rely on somebody else to form our own opinions because there are so many resources out there for us to kind of tap into. And I think that's ultimately what I'm trying to do. And if I can do that, then I think we're all better off for it.
Cool. I like that. And I love a couple of the analogies that you use in there, which we're going to touch on in a bit. So change the conversation, feel confident having an opinion. Those are some of the things that you want to get to or get people to do as a result of this. The other question that I was interested to ask you was, do you think that people are skeptical about this topic, given that it can be and often is used as a political tool?
Yeah, it's there is a lot of skepticism. I feel it myself. Since writing the book and, trying to go out and kind of promote it and kind of talk about national security, found it's just real hard. I'm not a political guy. I have a hard time taking sides. And I think that's a real advantage when you're writing a self-help book, right? So again, it's not a us versus them type of thing. It's just really empowering the reader. But even there, I think people just are hesitant to engage. And I also think that that lack of information that we get is really opens the door for those loud voices to come in. We see it in the news, right? We don't know what's going on or what the grand strategy is or really the decision-making that's going on in government in order to kind of hopefully produce a better outcome. We're kind of exposed to the personalities on TV that want to tell us, well, this world leader is weak and this one is reckless and kind of get our emotions kind of, riled up. And again, I just think that the way you change that is just by being better informed, right? If we want to get, less of that, use the analogy BS. And the best way to do that is really to identify when they're giving us BS and be able to kind of just change the channel. So it is politically charged and it's a tough obstacle to get overcome. But I do think though that there's this kind of unspoken current, because we don't really want to get involved in the conversation and be lectured at and stuff like that, doesn't mean that there isn't interest of understanding what's going on in the world.
Excellent. No, and I think that's true. It's really getting across that sort of that position that you have, which is, is really just to hold things up to the light, not necessarily to say how they should look, but just so people can see them. Cool. Now, I haven't asked this question yet, and I debated where in the conversation to ask, because this is perhaps the first challenge for people is to understand what actually national security is. And I think, and you use the analogy of the communities, and I think that's a great starting point. But how would you, with your experience in the forces, using all of the sort of expertise you got from the degrees and the studies that you've done, how would you define national security?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really wanted to come at this subject from a completely different lens. I really thought that we had to, if I was going to really kind of be able to reach out to broader audiences, I really had to break the mold about how we talk about it. And certainly how we define national security is a big part of that. So actually, I kind of take that on at the beginning of the book. You can't write a self-help book on national security without being able to define it, right? So let me ask a question. Have you ever played the game 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon? Have you ever heard of that game?
I've heard of it. I've not actually played it myself.
So it's for the benefit of your audience, it's fun little game we play, maybe here in the States. And the idea is that you can connect any celebrity to Kevin Bacon within 6 steps. And, you know, the reason I bring that up is that it's kind of true in national security as well. There isn't a topic out there that you can't connect in national security within like a few short steps, right? Healthcare, education, supply chain management talk is the big one these days, right? You know, you can basically tie anything to national security in just like a couple, you know, a couple moves. And because you can do that, it's very hard to define it. If you cast such a wide net, everything is a national security issue, then nothing becomes a national security issue. You know, it's just, it makes it very hard to have discussions around it. You know, I looked at definitions in places like Wikipedia and dictionary.com, and these would be things that I would be more familiar with in the military. You know, the more formal definitions, like kind of expressing diplomatic and economic and military influence around the world, or you might find something that talks about the relations we form with other nations, you know, those kind of things. But, you know, I thought they were too stuffy as a definition for a self-help book and, you know, the kind of, you know, for an introduction for us. And, you know, I didn't like the fact that none of them talk about the value of being secure. Yeah. And I go through the book, this kind of like diatribe where I really want to kind of drive that point home that feeling secure matters, right? So if we don't feel secure in the food we eat, how could we ever order a pizza? You know, if we don't feel secure in our electronic banking, you know, how could Amazon ever exist? And if we don't feel secure in public places, you know, how could we go to a concert of a public fair? So feeling secure matters because it allows us to create and innovate and express our individuality. If you have a great idea, you know, like a self-help book on national security, perhaps, there are things called patents and copyrights that secure them from others that want to, you know, kind of claim them as their own. And so what I want to get across in the definition of national security is that it's not just about the military and the diplomacy and all that kind of stuff. It's also about our authors and our writers and our artists. It's our values that we secure and how we express those values that really matter. So I came up with my own definition, and I kind of define national security. I'm trying to remember it off the top of my head, but it's basically securing the interests and values of a nation, community, and a people. And that's not going to win me any really awards in national security circles, especially when you start entering the people and the community side. I thought it was important because it's a reminder, I think, to the reader that we're not in this big world alone. And if peace and prosperity is what we're looking for, you know, we should also be willing to bring other people along with us.
Cool. I like that. And that sense of, well, it's interesting to think about the connections. And, you know, I know I was talking to someone in America just the other day, and they were quite exercised about the whole TikTok thing. You know, that's a great example of where it's really, you know, you brought it up, but how connected it is to things that we do every day and perhaps take for granted every day. So I think there's some that's really helpful. And that sort of feeling of security, you know, if we don't feel secure, and I think we can just look at those countries who are at the moment not secure, how devastating it is to those people to be able to, they can't live a normal life. So in a sense, it's about us feeling able to live, you know, whatever you call a normal life, but to live our lives, you know. So that's really interesting, a definition that you put out there. You know, one of the questions that I had, you know, this podcast goes out to 190 plus countries. It is possible that national security means different things to different nations based on their own ideologies. But I guess that the way you expressed it, which is around values and so on, for them, that would still fit, because they would have their own values. Do you think that's right? Yeah. Do you have anything else to say on that?
Yeah, that one? You know, I titled the book Searching for True Community. I got the title from here in the United States, civil rights pioneer Pauli Murray, who I don't know if you're familiar with, but she had obviously very influential in the 1950s and 60s here during the civil rights movement. And she had defined true community as one based on equality, mutuality, and reciprocity. And she kind of observed that it requires, you know, kind of us to embrace our diversity and the goodness of our diversity, but also to be able to embrace our common humanity. And you need them both. And in order to really survive as a, what would you call a true community? I call it searching for true community because we quite haven't gotten there yet.
No.
And you know, and we may not, you know, kind of get there. It's really that struggle of us trying to kind of, you know, reach that true community and, you know, kind of interact as a global community in a, I guess, in a productive way, you know, raise our standard of living higher and higher, giving more and more people the ability to kind of pursue their own dreams and kind of define their own futures. You know, if we can get there, then we're in a much better place. You know, but, you know, it is a very diverse community out there. Some 200 nations out there, all sorts of different forms of government, different cultures, different, certainly religions and all sorts of different influences for, you know, how we define ourselves. And in a way, national security is that conflict that exists for all of us, where really trying to kind of protect our self-identity from the, what I would say, the intrusion of community norms, right? Each nation really has to go through that, you know, themselves and kind of determine, you know, kind of what their role is in the world and how they're going to embrace their neighbors. So you're broadcasting in 190 nations, and maybe I could, you know, maybe use this one example as a good way to kind of talk about it. Most of those 190 nations, I think, would identify in what is called the non-aligned movement. It's actually the largest collective body in the United Nations. It consists of about 120 nations, and it's really a loosely aligned alliance, but it's nations that we would kind of describe here in the States as the global South, right? Because they consist mostly of Latin America and Africa and maybe Southeast Asia. And a lot of them have a complicated history with colonialism. They have certainly their own internal strife and those kind of things. But, you know, they taken this kind of neutrality position, right? They think they've really taken this position that it's in their best interest to take a very kind of strict and reading of the United Nations Charter and international law. And they see that's really the best way for them to protect their sovereignty. And, you know, and it also gives them a little bit of advantage when, you know, they want to negotiate deals in their benefit. If you don't take sides between the great powers, then, you know, you can negotiate deals for yourself on, you know, whatever matter kind of want to negotiate on. Right. So there's kind of a practical, I think, advantage to doing that as well. Conflict that comes up is that when you're taking this kind of neutral position and you're really focused on that black letter of the law, you also don't really take sides in moral rights and wrongs, right? It's hard for them to kind of, I think, you know, assign blame for bad acts. And that can be frustrating, I think, for Western democracies that really see those kind of, you know, those morals, rights and wrongs, and the need to actually kind of call them out. And you see this kind of playing out a little bit on the global stage today. A lot of it's you have these resolutions that are at the Security Council calling for, you know, a ceasefire in Israel. And you see kind of the United States and maybe some others that are kind of vetoing them because they're demanding that, you know, in those resolutions that there is some sort of kind of comment related to how the conflict started and, you know, the need to kind of, you know, call that out. But these other nations don't want to do that, right? And so we're kind of stuck in this stalemate, almost seems like, where we have these ideological differences on not just internally in terms of how we find ourselves within our own borders, but I think largely what the international law really should be and how we progress ourselves forward. And I think it's going to set up a challenging kind of next kind of future kind of decades where we really wrestle with this conflict between, you know, what do you do with injustice in the world when what is what we can see is just and what is legal are necessarily always aligned. And I kind of go through some examples in the book about that, you know, just to kind of, you know, kind of throw that out there. That's a real challenge.
It's interesting. So it's one of those wicked problems, isn't it? Where it's difficult to sort of find that one true way. I remember watching films like Independence Day and stuff like that. And I always think, oh my goodness, like if there was an external threat to the earth, everyone like that, when you see those films, all the nations come together and they recognize more what we've got in common than what divides us. And we don't want to homogenize every nation either, you know, in terms of what works for our country. You know, we can't just sort of say, right, here's the blueprint, you use that, you know, that's how you should do things. But so it's this really challenging, wicked problem, I think, that people, you know, that we need to sort of find our way through. But I love this, that concept that you're putting out there of true community, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, that would be amazing if we could reach that point, because we do have enough for everyone. Like, there is enough for everyone to, you know, live their life like in the way that you described. But, you know, there is stuff getting in the way, and it's really interesting.
Really, the hard question, I think, that going ahead with this kind of international investment we've made in ourselves over the last 80 years is, should we let that investment, I guess, impede our ability in order to enforce its ideals, right? Can we sit there and watch, you know, something happen and not do anything because there's no legal process that really supports action? Or should we do that? And I think on the other side, and maybe, you know, some of these other countries would ask, well, what are the point of having these international agreements when you can always justify a reason to break them?
Mm.
And that's really this kind of dilemma. And you hear this, I think, you know, when you kind of get that and you kind of, you know, put that in your head, you start to hear that conversation in the news. You know, the United States in particular, we're going out to, we're defending the international rules-based order and, you know, those kind of things. And, you know, messages from, you know, places like China and others that are saying, hey, the United States is the one that's kind of stretching the rules a little bit, not us. You know, they're the ones that are kind of the real danger. So it becomes a really interesting kind of this international conversation, at least as far as I can see it, that I think we sometimes miss because, you know, we're kind of eight layers deep into an issue without really understanding kind of the bigger picture. And I guess that's one of the kind of things I want to get across in the book is that, you know, before you can start peeling the onion back, right, you have to buy the onion whole. And so, you know, without that common reference to start from, you know, where our kind of legitimate differences can certainly turn into heated kind of arguments. And I think we can prevent that if we kind of had that common reference to start from.
I like that. That's cool. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, we've talked about national security. We've talked about, you know, people's understanding of it and so on. One of the things that I want to sort of have a look at your thinking and the way that you've approached this is you wanted to make this accessible to people. You have written a book about it. You are likely to go out and start speaking about it. You're doing social media posts to promote the book and all that good stuff. How do you go about making this approachable and relatable for audiences? I know that you've used analogy and metaphor. Just give me your thinking around how you do this.
Yeah, I think that's really it. I think what you said, the analogy and the metaphors in order to really kind of first make that connection, right? And then kind of dive into maybe it a little bit more. And, you know, the example, there are a lot of different examples to kind of use in the book. But one of them is, like I said, is like, you know, the way I introduced the International Criminal Court is I ask, have you ever seen the movie Life of Pi? And the reason I say that is, you know, you kind of start there with this common reference. You know, we've all seen this movie and we really loved it. And there's this tiger on there. His name is Richard Parker, you know, but Richard Parker is a real person. And we may not know that, but, you know, he was a real person and he was on a ship and the ship kind of was going around the Horn of Africa. I'm not the Horn of Africa, but going around the South there. And they wrecked and he was on a lifeboat with a couple shipmates. Or Richard Parker, unfortunately, went into a coma and his, you know, his shipmates decided that they were going to feed on him in order to survive. And the problem was that if you volunteer, you know, it was accepted custom to see that you could, you know, sacrifice your body for the others. But, you know, Richard Parker hadn't volunteered and he fell into a coma and he was murdered. And so the case that was kind of brought against the sailors, it's Regina versus Dudley and Stevens, is this idea that this necessity is never a justification to murder, right? And necessity is this kind of this idea that there might be times where you need to break the law in order to, you know, prevent a larger harm. And the reason that kind of ties back to, I think, the International Criminal Court, and the reason why the United States hasn't become a member of it, is because when you act out of necessity, it's usually based on your own values, right? It's your own sense of right or wrong that kind of causes you to act. The International Criminal Court, you know, they're kind of distant, right? They don't have those same values, right? They're looking at this thing, you know, maybe more objectively, or they're kind of looking at it, you know, maybe more by the kind of black white letter of the law. And so this kind of puts, you know, I think the United States and Western democracy is kind of in a position where if we feel a necessity to act, we also might be held responsible in a court, you know, on, you know, the other side of the world for whether that act is, you know, kind of criminal. We might see it as necessary. They may not. That's a long way to get around the horse, but that's just one example. And I bring in economics and, you know, Nobel Prize winning, you know, kind of literature type people and those types. And in order to really kind of start the conversation and kind of lead us down from there into something that's more substantive and something that you can really start to relate to in the news, and something, especially with the International Criminal Court, that, you know, you may not agree with it. There, I mean, certainly there's, you know, a big movement and loud voices here in the States that say, well, of course we should be part of the International Criminal Court. It's why wouldn't we be? It's about prosecuting war crimes. You know, it just makes sense, right? But, you know, you should at least understand the other side of the argument. And yeah, if we can understand them both, then I think we can, again, have better conversations and just kind of, okay, we may not agree and we may vote different ways at the polling booth, but we don't have to be at each other's throat while we do it.
Yeah, I like that. You know, I talk a lot about what you just did in this podcast about making things concrete and relatable for people. Taking complex ideas, technical ideas, and making them, sharing them in an everyday life kind of way. Yep. Where are the connection points? Where, how could you transpose that thing onto something that people will understand from their everyday life that has a similar sort of feel to it that you can then guide them in? Or even you don't, sometimes you don't need to go into the detail, as long as they get the concept. And I think that's what you did there with that reference to the Life of Pi film.
I mean, who knew Richard Parker could be such an influential person or tiger when it comes to international law? You know, entertaining stories are often incomplete stories. And I think, you know, if you were a international law professor and you read the book, and you would probably kind of say, well, yeah, hopefully you would say this is right, but you might say there's a lot left out, right? And there is, right? But the idea, again, you know, isn't to make you a national security expert. It's just a spark in interest, right? And, you know, kind of that base camps, you know, kind of analogy I made, you can now say, okay, you know, from that starting point, you know, maybe you kind of check out a Wikipedia page, or maybe you kind of go to the Hague and website, and you start kind of scrolling down just to get a little more information. You know, the idea is just to get you started, and, you know, kind of go down that journey. Or, you know, even if you don't, you can, you know, kind of meet some friends at a coffee shop and just kind of, I don't know, if you know, chat about the International Criminal Court.
Absolutely. And I think this is something I say certainly to my audience often, is that I think the real experts in a subject are the ones who are able to make it simple to understand. Because in order to describe something with that level of simplicity, you have to really understand it. I think the other point that I wanted to make here is that often, you know, we are all human beings, and you pointed out that we have a lot of things in common, and that there are lots of universal frames that we understand because, you know, essentially our lives are very, probably more similar than they are different in terms of we want to love, we want to be fulfilled, you know, we want, in all those things. So finding that point of connection that, you know, that across countries and cultures, that it does exist. And it is possible to tap into that if you can find the right example. And I guess you've had to do that in the book.
Yeah, it was a journey, the journey in the book, right, which was to get more conversational. So as I was kind of going through it, and again, you know, kind of challenged by how am I going to kind of describe this to somebody who doesn't know anything about national security, or, you know, doesn't really have an interest in it. It really challenges you to kind of, you know, figure that out. You know, it's only, like I said, it's less than 200 pages. It took me 3.5 years to write it because it was really that challenging of a kind of a project to take on. But I think that commonality that you talked about is just people. You know, it's just, you know, our common desire to have a higher standard of living, to, you know, kind of chase our dreams, to kind of express our individuality and those kind of things. And I think that's what we can all kind of connect to. And I think that's what can really kind of connect you as well to international security and maybe international law and those kind of things. Because ultimately, when you look at all the different, you know, all these international agreements and all this complexity you talk about, I think it really just comes down to the grand strategy is just promoting people. You don't really need to be a military expert to understand Napoleon, right? You just have to read Oliver Twist. And you don't have to be a, you know, you don't have to study, you know, the American Civil War to know 19th century battle tactics, right? You just have to, you know, you could pick up Charles Dickens' A Christmas Story or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or something like that. And the point I'm trying to get across is that, you know, the wars we start and the tactics that we use to fight them have everything to do with how we value humanity, right? I almost feel like, you know, the Ghost of Christmas Past would have been better off if he visited Napoleon's base camp at Waterloo than you know, kind of haunt poor Ebenezer Scrooge, right? Right. Because I would have thought that at some point, Napoleon kind of sitting on a hill somewhere, you know, watching his armies march, doing whatever, would have just said, yeah, this isn't worth it. You know, I mean, it takes a lot of arrogance and a lot of, you know, I guess ego, right? In order to, you know, to line people up shoulder to shoulder and march them in the cannon fire, right? And it's that disregard for humanity and human life. And you kind of see that playing out today with this kind of conflict in Ukraine and this kind of, and the amount of people that are being killed that are being killed really for individual kind of ambition, right?
Ego
and those kind of things, right? Which really what it comes down to. And I think that in the end, you know, that's, you know, the grand strategy, right? The grand strategy is how do we kind of lift people up so they can demand more for themselves, to put more demands on their governments to help them achieve a more fulfilling life. And if we can do that, we'll have a much more peaceful place, you know, in the world.
Absolutely. So where does speaking fit into the picture? You're going to use it presumably to promote the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have come to the realization that boasting about national security is just like it's a bummer, right? And really over maybe, you know, the last several months and so I've been posting primarily on LinkedIn. And it's really been my journey to kind of figure out what exactly am I trying to say, right? But I found that really the best way, I think, to overcome all these obstacles, right? That it is a politically heated topic, that it is wonky, that a lot of us maybe don't want to venture into the unknown and kind of for fear that we're going to get lectured at or maybe feel belittled or something like that. I do think the best way for me to do that is to kind of just use my personality and just kind of get out there and just tell you that it's okay, you know? You know, the journey's up to you. You know, the idea is just to empower yourself to and to know that you have a voice. Whether you decide to use it is totally up to you. You know, it's a personal kind of growth type of thing. You know, I'm not gonna get there unless I can get out there in front of the audiences. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I think that's the kind of the way forward. And be honest, it's a bit of a challenge because we do see it as a very narrow and niche topic. And because of that, I think there's also the kind of the challenge of getting on stages, which quite honestly, I'm just, you know, impressed that you invited me on the show. So,
it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think, but it also takes a little bit of risk, right? So we're talking a subject that maybe, you know, isn't necessarily one that we talk about a lot. And so there is a little risk taking from the on the platforms that I'm looking to appeal to. And so, but you know, I think I can get there.
Excellent. Brilliant. Well, look, thank you for sharing everything so far on national security and how, why it's important for us to pay attention to and get more informed about. And I'll talk in a little bit about where people can find out more about you, connect with you and get the book and so on. But I have some standard questions to ask you.
Okay.
First one is, and it'd be interesting, I don't know what the answer is going to be to this. What has speaking done for you up until now?
Oh, you know, most of what I've done up until now have been more on the business side. And to be honest with you, I've actually found that it's actually created a little bit of an avenue for me, right? To be someone who is actually barely been outside after, right? So, I've worked in big organizations, and I think in my military time, and certainly when I left, and the great thing about working in them is that, you know, they're taking on big problems and they're doing big things, but they're also very compartmentalized and they're very regimented and those kind of things. And so when you're looking for someone who can articulate an idea, who can, right, you know, can stand in front of an audience and who can, you know, really just have a kind of a casual conversation like this on whatever interest this, you know, the business has, there's real value there. I, you know, in really kind of communicating those messages across and getting heads nodding up and down and engaging an audience to kind of really interact with you is, I think it's a real skill that not a lot of people have, and really been something that is separating me from my peers throughout my career. And it's really made me, I think, a better person. I think part of it is that law degree that I got and all that kind of stuff. There is kind of a certain, you know, kind of get out there and be a an advocate for your cause. I think the other thing, though, is, and maybe one of the reasons I wrote this self-help book was that I'm more of a pancake house guy than I am like a steakhouse guy. I just like being around people, and I like the non-pretentious, you know, what's going on in the world today type of discussions. And that's really helped me, you know, from a public speaking point of view.
Absolutely. I think getting your personality, being down to earth, being relatable is really important, and building rapport with an audience as well. So that's cool. Have you had a speaking gig that's not gone to plan that you are like, every time you think about it, you're like, oh my goodness, I just want to like wipe that from the memory.
So, yeah, again, most of mine are on the professional side. I was at a conference, and I was in the Pentagon. We were doing a big project, and it was, we were drawing down from Afghanistan. It was back in the Obama administration, not the current stuff, but we had a big problem. That was, you know, how to get all this equipment and stuff out, right? And get it out. And it really, you know, caused us to rethink how we communicate as an organization. You know, the timelines are really tight. We couldn't just stick with the processes and the organization we were. We had to kind of break the mold and go for it. So we came up with a good strategy, and we kind of planned. And it was my job as the kind of the head guy, face of the program, I think is the way that people would put it, to go out there and be the advocate. And, you know, I would go up to Capitol Hill with congressional staffers and, you know, all those places. And, well, anyway, so I remember this one conference. I'm walking. It's all my kind of peers in the Marines, all these senior officers and stuff like that. And I'm, you know, about to present our grand strategy. And I walk up, and my boss was, you know, next to me. And he says, just as I'm walking up, he goes, "We'll screw this up." And I go, I don't know what happened, but, you know, suddenly as I started speaking, I realized I was out of breath, and I couldn't say anything. I just stood there in front of this, you know, this big, you know, audience, and you don't want to just go, okay. So, you know, you're kind of like, I was stuck, and I was trying to get words out, but they were just mumbles, you know, and it was going nowhere. I could tell, you know, it was already kind of this strategy that no one had any confidence in, and I wasn't really doing us any favor. But then luckily somebody kind of threw some mercy and just kind of rambled on a kind of a long question, right? And so as they rambled their question out, I was able to kind of catch my breath really quick, and then I was able to jump into it. And then you know, me being me, I played it off in the end, you know, as kind of a little bit of a joke. But yeah, I remember that to this day, because, you know, I still get a little nervous when I get on stage.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that. It happens to all of us, but the important thing is to get back on the horse, as they say. So that's cool. Yeah. Right. Next question. What's the book that's had most impact on your life and why?
Oh, wow. The book that has the most impact on my life. I don't know if there is one. You know, there's not one that comes to mind. This is where I would say it's not a book, but maybe if you allow me, maybe a class. Art history was actually one of the ones that I really like. And it's real influence in the book as well. And the reason I like it, and you know, the reason I could, you know, I bring in like Oliver Twist into Napoleon and stuff like that is because you get a lot out of, you know, a painting or a novel or something like that. You know, if you take a kind of a painting, you can see the technology that was involved at the time, right? You can see, you know, basically catch the mood of the day, right? You can, you know, really kind of get a picture of what it was like, you know, to kind of live in that time, at least how that artist kind of expresses it. And I really kind of love that thought about doing that. Unfortunately, I still got, I think, a D in the class. But I love the material, and I love the kind of you know, the kind of, you know, diving into it and really having, trying to kind of interpret a broadening understanding by, you know, what's kind of in a four corner frame.
Cool. Okay. That's not had that. So art history. So using art as a way to get a handle on history is interesting as well in terms of,
Yeah.
people and cultures and all that good stuff. Okay, cool.
Well, and you know, I just say, yeah, I mean, you can really get a parallel between, you know, kind of, again, you know, if you kind of read Oliver Twist and you kind of, you know, get a sense of how we valued people and we value humanity, it's not a big bridge to kind of cross to kind of go to Waterloo and see all these guys lined up shoulder to shoulder and kind of march it into musket fire, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I often use Oliver Twist myself as a as because just as a side note, Charles Dickens used that book to change the way that Victorian society viewed the poor, that story, because he made the poor victims of circumstance rather than sort of immoral and evil. But this is the whole power of a story to change. And so it's a great, I love that book too.
Yeah, and I think you know, I know we're supposed to move on from the book, but I think, you know, one of the things that kind of emphasizes that, you know, it's not the generals that really demand change. It is those authors and it's those artists, right? It's the businessmen like Henri Dunant who formed the International Committee of the Red Cross, and you know, he became the first Nobel Prize winner. And then here in for peace, and then, you know, here in the United States, you know, we had a patent cleric as our own humanitarian champion, Clara Barton, who kind of brought those principles, you know, kind of to the States. And it's, you know, kind of getting back to this, you know, when we kind of raise people up to have their voices, we get better outcomes, right? Those are just great examples of that, right? And so certainly Charles Dickens is part of that story, and Jules Verne is, and all those. And I think that's a and that's really something I really want, hopefully the reader gets when they kind of take on the book.
Fantastic. Okay, penultimate question. What's the best bit of business advice you've ever had and why?
I think, you know, maybe the best advice I ever got was, that's a good question. I'm trying to think of it. I guess, you know, for me, it's just, you know, just go for it. Don't overly think about what's going on. Don't kind of paralyze yourself. You know, in the Marines, we always said, you know, the 80% solution today is better than the 100% solution tomorrow. That was kind of always a thing. And do that. But I think the other part too is don't forget the people you got to bring along with you, because you're not going to survive out there on your own. You're going to need to lean on someone. You're going to need to bring them with you, and their, you know, their skill sets are different from yours. You know, one of the things I kind of recognize wherever I go is that I have a broad range of experience, and I have maybe kind of a broad knowledge base. But I'm not an expert. You know, I'm not an HR person, right? I'm not a, you know, account payable. I'm not, you know, one of those people that really knows, you know, that area of a business. I know enough to have maybe a decent conversation, but I wouldn't kind of throw myself out there as somebody who could be, you know, a VP of HR or something like that. And so I guess that's really it, right? You know, kind of be aggressive may be the wrong word, but don't overthink, but bring people with you.
Cool, I like that. That's great. Last question then. If you can have one mentor, they can be alive or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would you choose and why?
That's a, you're asking like all the harder questions. So that's a, I wish I, yeah, these are the ones that you wish you were prepared for. I think if I had to choose a mentor, I don't know. I think I'm kind of thinking business, but I don't know if there's anybody really in business that I really kind of trying to think of someone who has much more of a worldly kind of presence about them. Yeah, I mean, I guess what I just keep on going back to is my great grandfather, and he's not really like a history. He's not somebody you would know in history, but he's somebody that I guess really goes back to my core because, I'm a Van Bennekom, so I'm from Holland. He, as a young kid, he really left Rotterdam to take on a life at the sea, and as you kind of read his life experiences, kind of traveling the world and being involved in a small way in these kind of big historical events that were happening, it's really kind of a neat perspective because he wasn't a captain of a ship or anything like that. He was just a kind of below decks kind of guy and just trying to make a living, and he would eventually emigrate here to the States. And during that time period he was alive, as a seaman, right? You had World War I and World War II, and he had all this stuff going on in the world, and he was always telling, kind of writing down his stories about transiting back and forth on the in the Atlantic and supporting humanitarian relief of Belgium and being involved in, a mutiny at sea one time, those kind of things. And I guess what I would ask him or want to talk to him about is just, what really drove him to go do that? Like what was it about him that just wanted to leave home in Rotterdam and spend his life kind of traveling the world and those kind of things? What was it really attractive about it? Because I kind of have that in me. I don't do or I haven't historically really done well with someone else's curriculum. But I've always wanted to go out and be adventurous and kind of do my own thing and really take risks and kind of expose myself to critics and do all those kind of things. And so I guess maybe it's a cop out, but I think if I had to choose one person, that might be him.
I don't think it's cop out. I think we got to the right answer, so that's cool. And often people do have someone in their life that is, that's who they choose, and that's completely cool. That's brilliant. Listen, David, thank you so much for coming along and having a chat to us today about this nebulous, challenging puzzle that we have, national security, and how you've tackled that and making it accessible for people. Now, if people want to connect with you, where's the best place for them to do that?
Yeah, I think if you're on LinkedIn, I'm always trolling on LinkedIn. I think that's the best place for me. Certainly, I'm on X and Instagram and those kind of things, but I spend most of my time on LinkedIn. So yeah, feel free to connect with me. Yeah, love to hear from you and anything that you can suggest on how to kind of better communicate about national security, I'd love to hear it.
Cool. And where should people go and get the book if they
Yeah.
want to do that?
It's anywhere you buy your books, your ebooks. They're, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, those kind of things. I publish through a site called bookbaby.com, and so you can definitely go there to get a hard copy if you want. And I am currently working on a audio version. Unfortunately for you, and you kind of get a taste, it's going to be my voice. So, but hopefully in the next few weeks I'll have that out, and you can definitely look for it there as well.
Smashing. Well, we'll put the links to all of those things in the show notes too. So, all that remains for me to do is to wish you best of luck with it and to say thank you once again.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed the conversation and it was a lot of fun. So, thank you.
There you are then. I love the way that David uses such a diverse range of hooks to draw his audience into this subject. And the thing is, like, once you do that and they start to make a few connections, suddenly the big picture becomes so much clearer. And you can see why getting a better understanding of this stuff is so important, because of the multiple ways that it touches our everyday lives without us even realizing it. Well, I hope that you got some light bulb moments from this interview, not just about national security, but also for how you can make your topic more engaging for your audience. And if you did get value, then would be wonderful if you could jump on LinkedIn and let David know. And his links for that are in the show notes. And do also go and grab a copy of the book if he's piqued your curiosity, which is called Searching for True Community, a self-help book on national security. And there are also links to get it in the show notes. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, if you're a regular listener of the show, first of all, thank you. And second, if you would do me a big favour, if you could take a couple of minutes just to leave a rating or review for the show, I'd be super, super grateful. And you can do that over at ratethispodcast.com/TSC or wherever you're listening. Well, that's it from me. I'll catch you next time. But until then, you know what I'm going to say? Don't forget to go out, grab your life by the nuts, and get cracking. Bye-bye. It's a nightmare. You're an expert with so much to say, but now that you've been booked to speak, you're struggling to know exactly what to talk about. You want a talk that engages the audience and wins you new clients without you losing your personality or anyone feeling pitched to. But what happens when you sit down to create that talk is that you end up staring at a blank page for ages, or worse, surrounded by hundreds of sticky notes with content that you could include. With so much material, you just don't know where to start or finish. Don't worry, because many experts like you face exactly the same challenge. And that's why I created the Blank Page to Stage Guide. In just 50 minutes, this breakthrough resource is going to help you identify the big idea of your message, make it relatable for the audience that you're speaking to, and convey it all in a way that gets the audience inspired and on board with your idea. And it works even if you have tons of material or your subject feels less than exciting. If you want to cut through swathes of content and get a talk that you're excited to share, your audience loves, and wins you new clients, then grab your Blank Page to Stage guide from saraharcher.co.uk/newguide-TSC. Oh, I forgot to say, it's completely free. Enjoy!